Good afternoon, everybody. I hope you enjoyed your sumptuous lunch of LSE sandwiches and are still in a fit state to pay attention. Welcome to the afternoon. I hope you've enjoyed this morning. I certainly did. This afternoon, as you may have spotted, I'm not Anne McElvoy. Sorry, I should have said that. I'm not Anne McElvoy. Sadly, Anne has been otherwise detained, so you've got me to chair this. If you weren't here earlier, my name's Charlie Beckett. I used to work as a journalist at places like the BBC and ITN. I'm now a professor here at the Department of Media and Communications, and I run POLIS, which is the think tank that is hosting this event. The theme of the whole conference is this idea of crisis, and there's nothing new particularly about the idea of extreme violence, terrorism. It's always interesting talking, for example, about students who, my students, often come from other places where that kind of extreme violence has become part of their lives, often quite recently. And it reminds me that, you know, as Brits, we too had a long period of Irish-related terrorism. And it's strange to think about how we lived, as it were, with that, or perhaps it was on another island, but and how that has changed. And partly about how the media around it has changed, that the reporting of Irish terrorism was incredibly simplistic in many ways, and it makes me think about how good we've been at trying to grapple with what I think is a much more complex kind of extreme violence and terrorism that we have in the world today, most notably, of course, with what the BBC still insists on calling the so-called Islamic State. And complex not just because of its causes, which are manifold, and also its plurality, that you know, there are obviously other forms of terrorism, Boko Haram and so on, but also the way that it exists in a particular locale, but then the way it's become globalised, and the way that, as I said at the very beginning of this conflict, this conference, that that kind of conflict has quite deliberately spilled onto the streets of European cities, but has also very much become part of our whole debate about, you know, multicultural societies, allegiances, and even just simple causes of why people from, you know, my kids' school, why young people from that school would choose to go to join with ISIS. So a whole range of very complex issues, and we're going to look not, well, if we can solve those issues, that's marvellous, but we're really looking at how journalism investigates, reports, and represents those issues. And that is why we've got such a diverse panel who are able to bring, I hope anyway, insights into that kind of complexity and how we understand it through media. What we're going to do is I'm going to ask each of them to kick off with their own thoughts and explain a little bit about why this issue matters so much to them, and what they think is important about the role of news media journalism in that. And then we'll, I don't know, have a bit of a chat and try and get you engaged as early as possible as well. So prepare your questions and insights as well, and we'll have a good hour. And I'm going to kick off with an old friend and somebody who I always find, I'm going to set the bar high now, provocative on any kind of issue, frankly, but Sunny Andal is going to kick us off.
Thanks, Charlie. I'm interested in this issue from the perspective not just of where journalists play a role in terrorism, but also how we as consumers and producers of journalism in social media especially play a role. November last year was when the Paris attacks happened. A few days after the Paris attacks, a woman, an American woman called Brenda Liss, posted on her Facebook saying, with nine pictures, and she said, It's terrible what happened in Paris, but look at what it's happened after France attacked Syria. And she posted a bunch of pictures about people dying, planes bombing Syria. That post got shared 176,000 times, seen by about 10 million people, I would say, maybe more. And none of those pictures were actually from where she was talking about. They were all fake. As in, none of those pictures were from the aftermath of what France did in response to the Paris attacks. One was a computer-generated picture. One picture was from Turkey. Another one was from a Syrian attack by ISIS about a year ago, and so on. I went through all those pictures. Some of those pictures we couldn't locate. But I know that those pictures did not come from Syria. Those pictures did not come from the aftermath of the Paris attacks. The same thing happened in Dubai. A man uploaded his own, another picture. He said that France, as a retaliation for the Paris attacks, has killed thousands of innocent Muslims. That post was shared 17,000 times, seen possibly by hundreds of thousands, maybe a million people. Again, the picture was from actually a Russian attack, I believe in Syria, but it's not clear, and that was taken several weeks ago. That picture was circulating on social media several weeks ago, before even the Paris attacks happened. So this kind of shows you how citizen journalists play a role, or just not even journalists, just citizens play a role in shaping our views around terrorism. And I want to make three points on this issue of how the media plays a role in, whether it plays a role in exacerbating tensions around terrorism or not. The first is, we can't just look at media in isolation. We also have to look at how we play a role within social media in the discussion around terrorism. And actually, my view is that we make it worse. And we make it worse because, firstly, we gravitate towards information which confirms our prejudices. We don't actually want information. It's just a psychological thing. We don't want information that challenges us. Generally, we gravitate towards information that confirms our beliefs. And then we like to share it with other people. And people who are shown facts, and this is just it's shown in several studies, if people are shown facts which contradict their beliefs, they not only reject those facts, they also move even stronger towards the opposite. It's like the Donald Trump effect. The more you say that Donald Trump is a nasty guy, the more people gravitate towards him and say, no, actually, he's the guy who's going to be saving the United States, because those people who he hates, if they hate Donald Trump, so he must be doing something right. So actually, in one sense, the more people say, actually, these pictures are not from Syria, it's not what the France has done, whatever, people think, you must be lying. You must have some sort of an agenda. Therefore, you know, this must be true. That's the first problem. The second problem, I believe, is that the media companies, outlets, are not doing enough to debunk the myths that are out there. A good example is a myth that I've spent ages debunking and telling everyone on my Facebook for ages that it was untrue, was this claim that Edward Snowden had revealed that the head of ISIS was a Mossad agent and he was trained by Israel. Now, this claim went around everywhere. I looked at the websites, one called globalresearch.ca, another one, the Moroccan Times. Those posts were shared over a million times, liked or shared a million times across Facebook, just Facebook alone. And it was untrue. I actually asked Glenn Greenwood directly, who is the guy who had the most closest work, who's done most close work with Edward Snowden, and he said to me it was untrue. Edward Snowden had never said anything about the leader of, who trained the leader of ISIS. And he also told me privately that he had spent ages telling everyone that this was untrue, and still people would share it, and still people were spreading this myth. Another myth, the most famous one of them all, that President Obama is a Muslim. The number of people who believe that has actually gone up in the last 8 years, while thousands and thousands of articles have been published in the national media saying that this is untrue. The percentage of Americans who believe it to be true has gone up, not down, despite the media debunking. Which brings me to my third point, which is that actually part of the problem here is that there is a deep fallen trust of the media itself, which correlates with people not believing stories about terrorism. So back in the days when conspiracy theorists were just, on the fringes of YouTube, these days those stories get shared on the front page of your Facebook account, and then people share those stories and they think, and the, it's usually headlined with something like, this is the story that your media will not tell you or your government is hiding from you. And those kind of, it's clickbait, but it works. And because there is a growing distrust of the national media, it plays into that, and therefore people are willing to believe these kind of fringe theories, and then they share them, they rarely fact check them. So the media is making it worse because in many ways, what the conspiracy theorists are doing now is they're following what the media has been doing for years, which is having a headline which totally does not correlate with the story itself. And you've seen the Daily Mail do this loads of times, which I believe is the worst example of this. But now, the question is, can we in the media complain when people out there with their own websites and stuff are doing what the Daily Mail has been doing for years? You know, in one sense, we can complain, but nevertheless, it's working for them as well. So you've got these three problems, which is we are making it worse because by not fact-checking, that the media itself is losing trust because of its own tactics sometimes. And thirdly, that... I forgot what my third point was.
That was three, wasn't it?
It's not doing enough to debunk the myths.
Yeah, it's not doing enough to debunk those
myths.
See, I was
listening.
Sorry.
Okay.
So, yeah. Final point. Brendlis, the lady who published that post, which got shared 176,000 times, eventually, a month later on, deleted her post. I didn't message her, but she deleted it. But by that time, the damage was done.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Okay. In a second, I'm going to get Rohit and Lucy, if you like, they're kind of as our representatives of mainstream news, at least, to come back on that. But I want to get Sukunda, because Sukunda, your work, in a sense, does try and dig much deeper into very uncomfortable areas, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Although I imagine perhaps Lucy and Rohit might say that they're doing the same. I work for Newsnight, and over the kind of past few years, I've done a number of interviews with people who have joined ISIS or have been supportive of ISIS and attempted allegedly to carry out attacks in Europe. I recently made a documentary for Panorama that was kind of looking around the background of the people who committed the Paris attacks and who it later emerged were also involved in the Brussels attacks. The reason that I first got interested in this subject wasn't because I was attracted to the idea of exploring extremism or violent extremism per se. I was interested in exploring subcultures and understanding why people gravitated towards them and understanding how they use those subcultures to define their identity in a modern world. And it just so ended up being that in a kind of the most kind of dramatic expression of this fractured sense of identity and fractured sense of subcultures, to my mind, ended up being the attraction that many young British and European Muslims had towards groups like IS and their ideology. And so I was always motivated at trying to understand kind of what was going on in the psychology behind them. And so I would like to think that much of my work has tried to focus on trying to get to the root cause of that and try and understand what's behind that. And this conference was interesting for me because it raised the question of how we see ourselves as journalists and what we see our role as being in relation to the kind of the phenomenon of extremism. I mean, I think it's it's almost problematic, I think, to conceive ourselves as having a direct and active role in combating extremism. That's not how I see our roles as journalists. It's not to have a particular stance, especially when you're dealing with something that, with the term like extremism, which can have so many different meanings. But what I do think is important is that we try and explain the nuances within these really polarized debates, and so that we can understand, for example, that right now there's a war happening between Al-Qaeda and ISIS. You know, I did an interview with someone who is in Al-Qaeda, and he was telling me, you know, look, I totally oppose ISIS, but, you know, there's one good thing that's come out of them, and that's that they show lots of Muslims, in his words, that Al-Qaeda are the middle ground, that they're between the sellout kind of pro-Western secularist regimes and the extremists of ISIS. And, you know, it's really important that if we want to understand these phenomenons, that we understand the nuances to these debates, and that we don't just simplistically label everyone as being the same thing. And, you know, I think there's an argument for saying that, you know, that's increasingly happening in certain sections of the media and in certain sections of politics as well. And, I mean, I think there's also an argument that perhaps some of the reporting around some of these events has kind of heightened tensions. I was in Molenbeek for a number of weeks after the Paris attacks, and the kind of one complaint that a lot of young people there who totally opposed ISIS and totally opposed violent extremism had were comments made by a French kind of critic who talked about how instead of bombing Raqqa, Europe should be bombing Molenbeek. And they really, really felt alienated by that. And it was consistently brought up by people as saying that, look, these kind of comments and the kind of prominence attached to them in the media that is driving us kind of further away from the mainstream, and it's making us harder to have conversations with other people who are perhaps attracted to groups like ISIS to say, listen, that's not the right way of, you know, expressing any grievances, you know, see through things. And I think, on the other hand, there's a lot of, you know, questions that are raised for journalists when you're in this field about what is responsible reporting. And, you know, we've seen groups like ISIS develop a really sophisticated propaganda kind of machine, and part of the media seems to kind of thrive upon that because, you know, Sunny was talking about clickbait, but you've got basically, you know, videos that are kind of really, really brutal, but that people want to see because they kind of fetishize them. And there's a kind of desire in some media circles to kind of capitalize on that and kind of put the videos up and use them. But it's a dilemma, I think, that we need to be conscious of, because we're on the one hand can be seen as giving an oxygen of oxygen of publicity to these groups. On the other hand, we can't just ignore them because they're out there, they're on the internet, and people are watching them. And if we don't report on them and talk about them, then it's not going to stop people, you know, reading them or watching them and being perhaps influenced by them. So I think this area throws up lots of kind of difficult questions. And I think the growth of social media and the accessibility of speaking to the people who are directly involved in those events, whether they're in Syria or Iraq or other places in the world, and the ease with which those groups can kind of throw out their messages, make you know, everything a lot more complicated. And I think, you know, everyone from journalists to politicians and the police forces are still struggling to kind of articulate exactly how we should navigate our way through this territory.
Come to Rohit next, because you're security correspondent for ITV News, and in that sense, you know, you have that job of on a popular news bulletin, you know, where you have to be able to put things into an easily understood couple of minutes. But you wrote a fantastic article for HuffPost where you were talking about walking a tightrope between balancing some of the things Sukunda just mentioned, really, you know, the your sources and the statements from, I don't know, the security services, plus your awareness of, you know, the effect on communities and so on. How do you solve that? How do you resolve that?
Well, it's incredibly difficult. I've been security editor for ITV since November, since a couple of weeks after the Paris attacks, and the reason that role was created, I did some of the domestic stories about extremism and counter-terrorism in the UK, but that what role was created really is a response to Paris, the idea that these things, you know, don't go along national borders. And
that's interesting. So they actually, that wasn't a kind of response.
Absolutely,
to,
that's yeah, interesting, right? Absolutely. And previously we had covered terrorism as a home affairs issue, and we covered you know, foreign terrorism as something happening over there somewhere far away, and the idea was to sort of link up the two and to try and help explain to people, you know, the sort of association and the pathway from one to the other. It's really difficult. I think so much, and every time I file a story, I think more so than in any previous job I've had, so much of the trust and the credibility of the organisation is tied up with what you're saying, because terrorism really sells, obviously. You know, you look at the front of the Daily Mirror yesterday, which was talking about this apparent plot to ISIS plot to put weapons underneath sun loungers on Mediterranean beaches, and then you sort of, you know, what you realise is, number one, it's been completely denied. And number two, they're talking about Boko Haram rather than ISIS. But what you see in that front page splash is the word ISIS on the front of a newspaper is perceived as being a selling point. And a big part of my job is actually reining some of that in and saying to programme editors and saying to news editors and to executives, actually, you know what, that's not a big deal, or you know, or actually this is what's really interesting here, and explaining, or certainly attempting to explain some of the you know, the nuance of these cases. You know, proportion is what we always aim to have, and you know, there is an argument that we've got all of this out of proportion. There is an argument that we over-report IS, I mean, you know, Islamist extremism has claimed one life in Britain in the last 10 years, you know, which isn't to say it's not a specific and a great threat, but, you know, it's killed fewer people than bee stings, you know, that... You know, one person in the last
so-called bee sting.
The so-called bee sting. And in fact, in the last 10 years, one person has died driving their Segway off a cliff in Yorkshire. So, you know, in terms of detail, in terms of the actual numbers, you know, that is one way to characterise it. Of course, you know, it's not the same though. And as you touched on there. Part of this job involves trying to balance this plurality of sources. And so that article was in response to a piece that Peter Preston had written in The Observer, who was saying that security correspondents need to basically, he didn't quite say give up, but he said your sources are all in the shadows. And actually, I think, perhaps during the height of Irish terrorism, that might have been the case. But I think now, given that this is a story that stretches, you know, from Ladbroke Grove to Luton to Paris to Brussels to Raqqa, Tunisia, Algeria, Mali, Somalia, you know, all across the world. And also given the importance and the prominence of social media in all of this, I just think there is such a diversity of sources where we can be gathering our information, and increasingly my job and the job of people doing similar jobs, it is to basically sort the fact from the fiction, to try and explain what is reality. You know, in a world where there is just this huge wealth of online material, trying to work out what's important, which is, you know, really sort of basic, some might say old-fashioned journalism, but, you know, every day there could be a temptation to splash, you know, with that first bong on News at 10 with some sensational, incredible video that you've just found on the internet. And, you know, for every one video like that that you do see on air, you know, there are obviously 100 more that someone has said, no, let's not go with that.
As with the beheading videos where...
Exactly.
We don't show them anymore. Lucy, obviously you've been in a number of places for the BBC, and obviously now Paris and with the attacks there. I'm interested partly in the social media thing, because, you know, when the Paris thing happened, I first saw it on Twitter, and interestingly, some of my students who were actually in Paris at the time saw it on social media, and of course it was, you know, the whole of Paris has been blown up and everything's in flames and it's an apocalypse, and then they would quickly try to find a brand that they could trust. Is that a similar experience for you, that, you know, that you find, like Rohit, that you're sort of swimming in this morass of social media when something like this, something huge like this kicks off?
I think it was a really confusing night to talk about the November attacks. And no, we actually heard the old-fashioned way, first of all, which was that one of the BBC cameramen was walking past a bar and saw 12 people dead outside. And you know, when the first report is 12 people dead, the alarm bells go off, and that's, you know, and that was where it was. I think what I would say is it's very different being in a city when that happens compared to going to a city to report it. I mean, everyone here, I think, will agree that it's not just that you can fly in and fly out, but, for example, in the November attacks, particularly, it's your own home that's been attacked. And so you're also, as a journalist, you're juggling fear and horror and trying to grapple with it, you know, as someone who lives there. And you're trying to report the story as neutrally and as responsibly as you can. And sometimes I think, I mean, one of the things I wanted to say actually is I think it's hard to be really self-aware about what you're feeling and how it's impacting your decisions in real time. And I think what I would say is that, I mean, we've covered, the Paris Bureau has covered the two attacks in Paris, the Charlie Hebdo attacks in January last year, the November attacks, and the Brussels attacks. And what really strikes me is that when you follow coverage of terrorist attacks outside the country, they can often seem to follow a pattern. They can seem quite similar, actually. There's a limited number of targets and weapons, and there's the casualty numbers, and the individuals affected by those attacks often have similar feelings of loss and stories. But when you're there, they're very, very different in terms of the impact they have on the cities they're in. And, of course, that impact changes things. It changes laws, it changes governments, it creates jobs at the, you know, other journalists' jobs. And it sort of, you know, it really feels different. So after Charlie Hebdo, Paris was very shocked, but very quickly people clung to the idea that most people are not political journalists, most people, well, you know, are not part of the Jewish community, and so the targets weren't them. And so it was very reassuring for them quickly to stand up and defend French values and freedom of expression, and I think that gave Paris back a sense of control and a sense of security. The Brussels attacks, there was a completely different feeling of resignation and, oddly, almost of relief that the thing they had been waiting for had finally happened and they could deal with it. The November attacks were something else, and I think that's because they were so general and yet so personal at the same time. There were attacks against everyone, you know, everyone who goes out to a bar on a Friday night in Paris, which is everybody, you know, and they were attacked in places that were very local, you know, local bars, local restaurants. They weren't tourist places. They weren't symbols of the state. These were bars that only locals would really know about or go to. And so there was a sense of being attacked in a place that you felt was safe, that was private, that it was inside knowledge that had led to these attacks. And all of that, I think, made it very difficult to cope with. And as a journalist reporting that, We arrived outside the Bataclan that night, and there was a sense that the situation was uncontrolled. And we got out of the car, there was a burst of gunfire. The police didn't really seem to know what was happening, where people should go. The public was milling around. There was no sense there was no sense of security. And I think things like that can affect you more than you think when you're reporting. An hour or two later, after the siege had ended, one of the policemen came out and looked very shaken and very scattered. And we called out and said, you know, how many dead? What's going on? And he said, they're all dead. They're all dead. There's 100 people dead in there. And at the time, you just sort of, it's just this disbelief. It can't be true. He must just be imagining it. And he was pretty much, you know, it's pretty much there. So I think the impact that has on your decisions to report, how much of the horror and fear that you're feeling do you report? Are you censoring it for your own needs, for the audience? You know, how do you make sense of that story when the parameters that you've put on it, the frame that you have for the story that night, has just been dissolved into something much bigger? I think it's quite good to be aware of that, because I think it can affect how you tell the story and who you interview and how you frame it.
I mean, one of the comments around, well, especially perhaps the Charlie Hebdo, because there were then the, you know, the demonstrations with all those lovely freedom-loving political leaders parading, you know, in Paris.
Yes.
And there was also, definitely with the Hebdo thing, the sense from the journalists that, you know, our community was under attack. But also, to a degree, the November attacks and the Brussels attacks, there's sort of what my colleagues here would call Eurocentrism, you know, that there was a particular, and I'm fascinated by what you say about being a correspondent in that city, which you then know, and is very close to you, that is there a danger that one becomes too emotionally engaged, and also perhaps the kind of them and us thing comes across much more strongly?
I think what I'm saying is it's important to be really aware as a journalist of the emotional reactions you have, and I think with hindsight, that night felt so chaotic and so scattered that I think it took 4 days before the team and I actually realised how affected emotionally we were by it.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, it's something that next time, or, you know, if it happens again, I would be really conscious of thinking, just taking half an hour out, or just thinking about how it was affecting how I was thinking about the story. Or even if I was so emotional that I wasn't thinking properly about the story, I think it's something to be aware of. It's not that it makes you a better or a worse reporter even. I think it can work both ways. But I think it's worth being aware of, and I don't think we were, you know, aware of how much we were affected by it.
Yeah. Yasmin, you...
You stole half my story, you know. you were saying sorry.
No, I was just saying, in the past you've been somewhat outspoken about the way that media sometimes shies away from confronting some narratives around this issue domestically. But you've also been critical of how it avoids looking at causes internationally.
Well, I mean, I'm glad you said, you know, the them and us. For me, that is the central problem. I honestly think that we've learned nothing since all those years ago when London was attacked. Actually, when, funnily enough, in that period of high and real crisis, I think the media was incredibly responsible and nuanced. But it seems to me that them and us has gone on and on and on. And so the points I wanted to make are these, that you can't really be reporting on or analysing or understanding terrorism. And it's lovely to hear the young people here, because relative to me, everybody's young now, having the sense that, you know, you have to have nuance, you've got to have depth, and so on. But what we need is not what we're getting. What we need in the globalized world is a much stronger sense on the part of the British and Western media that the fault line is between the destructive forces and the rest of us. And if we think like that, then we would have reported the Ankara deaths with as much passion as the Paris deaths. We don't do that. And we don't do that not because we are sitting there plotting, it doesn't occur to us yet. that the way we are presenting this thing is making it very difficult for those of us who come from elsewhere, who may or may not be of a Muslim background, that we are allies. Very often it feels to me that immediately certain lives are valued much more than other lives. All lives should be valued the same. We're not just looking enough also. You see, my terrorism report today, had I been doing it, would have been about Obama's visit to Saudi Arabia. That's a terrorism story. Because here is a leader of the world's most powerful nation kowtowing to and flattering the sponsor of world terrorism and the oppressor, violent oppressor of its own people. Yeah? That's a terrorism story. So we punish the pupils, we punish the brainwashed, we punish their families, we go and flatter those who have made this thing happen and will continue to do so. So it's the restrictive nature of what we think about as terrorist activities that we need to kind of think about. And the other thing is, you know, I have a very strong line on the drift towards Wahhabism that has now happened in the last 12 years, even in amongst my friends, amongst people I've known for a long, long time. This is not the Islam I grew up with, nor did many of us, and the drift has gone on. Now, to be a Wahhabi is not to be an extremist or a terrorist, but what happens then is exactly this idea of locked-upness, that we live in this way. This is our territory. I can't remember the very good word that you used. I can't remember. But it was this idea of no links between what's happening here and the rest of the society. And I think we need to explore that. A couple of weeks ago, I know everybody hates the Mail. Actually, I hate the Telegraph more, frankly, because it has an aura of respectability, and because they never ask me to write for them, and the Mail does and pays me good money. So I'm coming up front. Full disclosure. But what, and of course a lot that Mail does is absolutely anathema to me, but I wrote about, and you mentioned the word psychology. It's such an important word. It's such an important word because as the Wahhabism has grown, young people, third generation, maybe fourth generation, are being raised in families which are less and less, that are more unfree as society becomes more and more free. And there's a relationship between that. So as society becomes more and more permissive, and frankly, even as a parent, quite a free-thinking parent, that worries me, the response is to raise the children with much less autonomy and freedom. And the crisis, the internal crisis in the heads of young Muslim men and women surely matters. Why is it that when a white guy goes and kills people in Norway or a mass killer in America does what he does, the first thing we say, how were they raised? What's the psychological profile? When young Muslims do what they do in increasing numbers, we never want to interrogate their inner world. It's as if they're being commanded like aliens from external sources. So there are so many areas that are left untouched. And if we don't touch them, and of course there are some very good people who are doing it. I love Lise, she said, because she sort of does what I think more and more of us need to do. For her, there is no then manas. So when these terrible deaths in Kabul happened just a few days ago, even in the left-wing papers, it appeared on page 26 and a half or whatever. She really gave it prominence. She tweeted about it. She gave it all the force she would have given if she was in Paris. And I think that's how we need to be thinking about how to report terrorism in a way that builds trust, not breaks it. And I was very interested in what Sunny had to say, in a way that also counteracts the them and us that is going on online, which is the opposite them and us, which is the West hates us and they're lying to us and here are the pictures of what really happened. People would be less susceptible if they felt the whole story was at least being attempted. It's not an easy story, but we're not doing very well.
Okay, thank you. What I'd like to do is I'd like to get all the panel, not to, to sort of respond to what Yasmin said, although perhaps that is where you pick up on. I don't know where to start, really. Let's start with Lucy. How do you deal with all that complexity?
Well, I think one of the things, it was interesting listening, actually, one of the things I think is really important is the nuance of things. And one of the things that's come out of the attacks in Europe is how the profile of a lot of the young people who carried out these attacks. And talking to security experts in Paris and Brussels, they say the job is very difficult because the radicalization of these young people happens so quickly. It happens in a blink. These are not people who know their Quran. This is not people who spend years being convinced of an ideology. These are young people who are petty criminals, who drink and smoke and show no signs of which way they're going to go. So they're often known to the police force, the local police force, because they robbed somebody or they've been to prison. They're not usually known to the big high-up security agencies who are supposed to be responsible for tracking them. And so I think just bringing out some of those nuances and talking about the differing profiles of people who are carrying out these attacks and how they might not fit the stereotype, I think that's also important.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, when I was in Molenbeek, the one story that kind of always stuck with me was someone who told me about Brahim Abdussalam, who killed him, who blew himself up, killing people in the Paris attacks. And someone told me that he used to sit in a cafe that was basically a drug-dealing den with a joint in one hand, a beer in the other, watching ISIS videos. And that just summed up for me just how confused these people were and how kind of difficult it is to kind of fit them into a kind of a stereotypical mold of what some people might believe a jihadist is. I think kind of what Yasmin was saying about the kind of the different ways in which we report terrorist attacks in different parts of the world is something really interesting, and that's something that I think really resonates particularly with audiences around who have kind of heritage from abroad, who are living within Europe. I remember reading something, I think it was by Lindsay Hilsum, who is saying, actually, journalists do report these stories, because I remember straight after the Paris attacks, there were these horrific attacks in Beirut, which killed a lot of people as well, and it got nowhere near the same kind of pickup. The fact was that journalists were reporting on them, the public are not that receptive to doing it, and that's, I mean, it's a difficult position that you're in as a journalist, because your job is to inform people, but if people want to know more about what's happened in Paris because they perceive it as being closer geographically, politically, culturally, then and they don't want to read the article that's up on the BBC News website or the ITV News website about what's happened in Paris, then it's a difficult position that journalists and program editors are in about whether they're going to put that at the top of the bulletins or not. I can see it from both sides, and there's a I think there is kind of valid criticism to be made of the media there, but I think there's also a criticism of society. There's a kind of Sufi proverb that I like that relates to this that says, if you don't like your reflection, don't smash the mirror, smash your face. And it says, fundamentally, the media is not something kind of totally divorced from society, kind of that's top down telling people, care about this, don't care about that. There's a symbiotic relationship. And if the media is not giving these stories the prominence that perhaps many of us would like them to be given, that's also a reflection on society.
Yeah, it's sort of as the sort of center of gravity in the media shifts away from the old media, from organisations like ours that can actually sensibly make that balance between what people are interested in and what they think is important towards online media, which are judged more purely on the number of clicks they get. I mean, I guess there's something potentially quite worrying about that. But, you know, that point about this being a symbiotic thing is interesting. I mean, one thing that really struck me was the England-Holland game, I think it was, a couple of days after the Brussels attack. And there's a minute silence at the start of it, as you might expect. Talk about Brussels and acts of terrorism generally. But there's no mention of the IS attack in a football stadium in Iraq the week before. I mean, the parallels are blindingly obvious, and yet no one mentioned that. I mean, so the point being that this is far wider than the media, although we play a particularly important role in all of this. I think this is a far wider social issue.
But without being facetious, isn't there a kind of logic to that anyway, which is, you know, I care about the Premier League, I care less about the Bundesliga, but I don't care at all about the Iraqi League.
Yep. Absolutely.
So why should I...
Yeah, oh, well, yeah, I mean, and that's the point, and that's... I mean, that's the dilemma for all of us. I mean, proximity makes things feel more important, of course.
Now, can I just say, no, I don't agree with that, because you're all travelling, we're all having holidays. You know, there is a completely constant traffic between them and us. And the other thing is that you expect all the rest of the world, the West expects the rest of the world, to feel intensely when terrorist attacks happen here. Well, pay back, then. The same emotional investment needs to come from us. I find it extraordinary that we still live in a world where we don't accept that we're all in it together. I mean, I hate the Tories, but, you know, it's quite a good line. How can we not? How can we not?
Is that down to journalists, or is that down to the consumers of the...
Well, I still think, you know, Robert Fisk, who writes the most unfashionable journalism perhaps in the world, because it's all about the Middle East, about the constant chaos of the Middle East, often very hostile to Western interventions. He is one of the most respected and well-read journalists in the world. So it's not true that people aren't interested. You have to make them interested.
Yeah. Sunny, do you think that's possible? Do you think, that here's my loaded question, do you think it's just intellectual posturing by, you know, feather-bedded internationalists in London who go on about what about Lahore and stuff? Or do you think, as Yasmin says, that actually journalism could do a lot more to convince people to care about distant places? And connected places, sorry. Connected. Places that are connected.
I mean, I hate to disagree with Yasmin, but I do agree with this point that it's to a degree it is posturing, because it's actually very difficult to get people to care about a whole bunch of issues. And so it's frustrating because, I mean, like, just take this example, right? So I get a whole bunch of people on social media. I mean, in one sense, we're going through a transition phase now, especially using Facebook, because what we're doing is we're establishing links with people from all over the world who sometimes we agree with on issues, and then sort of distance people who are close to us geographically, but we don't agree with. So you sort of get this, like, how are these Americans, like, going for Trump? Like, these people are on a different planet. Whereas you can see yourself much more allied with, I don't know, liberals from Pakistan or other parts of the world, because you can see what they're saying and you agree with that. And I think that the media is having difficulty going through that transition phase, because obviously they're more geographically based. But just on this point, there's a whole bunch of Muslims on my Facebook feed who were really angry about the fact that Ankara and, Iraq did not get as much coverage as, you know. But then I was talking about the fact that a whole bunch of Ahmadis in Ahmadi Muslim guy in Glasgow got shot, killed because he was an Ahmadi. It's like a sectarian feud that's going on within the Muslim community. And when I talked about that, there was complete silence. Mm-hmm. You know, and so no one wanted to touch on that issue because they recognize it's controversial from within the community. And so there was a huge, like, a wall of silence in terms of talking about that sectarianism, or even saying, actually, we should condemn this. And so I think that people have their own biases, and it's very easy to point fingers at other people and say, you've got a bias, there it is. But people don't want to look inwards and say, okay, I also have biases. Like, for example, the Sikhs always complain. I mean, I'm from the Sikh community. They always guaranteed complain that no one pays any attention to them. And 99% of the time, it's true, because they don't blow up things and all that kind of stuff. You know, no one's paying any attention to the Sikh community. But a lot of the times, the stories are boring. And I say that to them, and no one wants to listen. They criticize me for saying that. So I think, you know, the fault also lies within us. I mean, as the Rumi saying goes, you know, it's kind of a reflection of where we are as a society. So there's no point blaming the media. The media is still going to be geographically based because it cares about clicks coming from their own country, because those clicks pay for the journalists. And actually, the transitional phase is that we're looking at the world through a much more international lens, through social media. And then we get angry when those events are not paid attention to. So, you know, these things are going to come up. What can you do?
It's more international, but do you think it's also that these days you have all the news apps and you can personalize them? So you end up just reading the things that you choose to read about. And in the old days, there was more of a sense that you were given, you know, some stuff you didn't know about with stuff you wanted to read about.
I disagree with that, because I do think actually Facebook and Twitter open us to far more sources and journalism and information by people that we would normally not be open to, unless you're the kind of person who only follows like five or six people and has a very small group of friends, which may be true. But I feel personally, and I feel a lot of other people get far more information. The problem is more psychological. There's a whole bunch of studies done into rumors that spread online. I looked into it as well, spent a lot of time looking at why do so many rumors spread online? How do they get debunked? Do people actually pay attention to them being debunked? There's a fantastic piece of research done by the Tao Center, Columbia, about rumors. And it just found that people psychologically hate information, which does not coincide with what their beliefs are. So it's less the filter that we're given, it's more our own psychological filter, which says, you know, I don't believe that information.
But you see, in the old days, you had to sit through a news bulletin. And so after watching a four-minute package in those days, at the end of it, you might think, actually, I'm more engaged now than I was at the start. Whereas these days, if I see something on Twitter that I don't know about, I might decide not to click on it because I'll click on something else instead.
There is that, but I feel the counterpoint to that is that the 4 minute package that you get in the news media or the half an hour news bulletin that you get is not enough. And I do welcome the fact that there are so many small news producers all over the world trying to raise awareness or trying to do stories, and I welcome that. So I'm not saying that we should just have the tyranny of the mainstream media, So therefore, in the one sense, on the one hand, it's great that the media has opened up, but on the other hand, some of it may be fake and people are sharing dodgy stuff. But I think it's better that we don't just have the half an hour news package now, and that dominance is broken.
Of course, yeah.
And you would, in a way, Ro, you are the, maybe not just the half hour, but in a way, that was what you were sort of saying before. Actually, was that you are conscious that you're not.
Yeah,
I mean, you're still the dominant impression. All the research shows that TV is still the most influential.
Mm. And actually, as social media grows, I mean, I personally feel, and I'm sure my colleagues here feel also, that the onus on us to be right grows as well. I mean, how many stories do we read on Twitter that just don't emerge on the TV news because that person actually didn't die that day, you know?
Or, the twin brother did.
and so you're right, and that's an interesting point, Sonny. You know, it there's so much information. I'm not sure how, you know, we all look at this as journalists, and I mean I don't assume. You know, we've sort of recently changed around news at 10, and part of the thinking is that by 10 o'clock in the evening, people have seen all the news on their smartphone. But my mum hasn't, so So you know, I think there's a you know, the half an hour bulletin of record is in a way enhanced by that diversity and plurality of information. I mean, in a way it's undermined, completely undermined, but in a way I think it's also enhanced.
Okay. I lied earlier. I said I was going to take.
Can I just
questions.
Make one that, very on. Quick point?
Go on, Yasmin.
Which is that we also have to look out for the silencing of certain aspects of this very important subject. I, to date, and maybe I'm wrong, I have not come across a single examination of the families of suicide bombers. There's a censorship here, or self-censorship. I want to know who they are, what they went through, what happened to them next. We never get to see or hear them. You know, so there are these places we are not allowed to go into. There are lots of other things that seem to me that we're accepting without question, including, of course, the prevent agenda at the moment, which is being forced into universities. So, the pretense of fairness and openness also hides the very dark corners where there's an understanding in the mainstream media we may not go.
Okay. Even less time for questions. In fact, no time at all, because we've got to get ready for the next session, which is on the power of the image. And just to remind you that there are two other simultaneous sessions in two other adjacent theatres coming up. But first of all, I'd like to thank the panel for what was an incredibly sophisticated discussion. Thank you.